Session number 6131, Reel 3.
Commander Dredge, Reel 3.
Well, the answer is that the supervisors were British and the workmen Chinese. And it worked very well.
Was it whilst you were at Hong Kong that there was the abolition of the salt pork ration?
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
I can only tell you about it. It was abolished. It was very much regretted. And our sub-lieutenant, he became an MP later on, Peter Agnew, who was a great stickler for the old ways, bought the very last salt pork to be had from the naval yard in Hong Kong. And we found if you throw it overboard in a net and stationed somebody at the stern with a rifle to keep sharks off, it became very good to eat indeed. Thoroughly soused in salt water. But of course we lost some bits through sharks and so on.
Was there ever any problem with typhoons?
Yes, they were terrifying things.
Can you tell me about
them? I never
had
a greater sense of powerlessness than when in a typhoon. We were caught by one typhoon in Fuchao Harbour, and we were fairly well sheltered there. But the wind blew the rails level with the deck. It's unbelievable, the wind, the force of wind, the typhoon. All you can do is to drop a second anchor and then very cautiously get full steam up towards it with your engines. A typhoon is no joke at all.
So you steam into the wind?
Yes, well, towards your anchors. You drop your anchors to hold the ship and then steam up to them.
Was there anybody ever lost overboard in the China Seas?
Oh, millions. Well, I would say thousands of people, yes.
I mean, from your...
Oh, no. You always made the men have a lifeline round them if they went on deck. If they went into the bows, into the aft.
Did the crew of the Bluebell ever keep pets on board ship?
Yes, they were always forbidden to. They always kept lots of pets. They always had one or two dogs. And after going down the South Seas, we had a wallaby, which was very happy on board for a long time, until some ass gave it mown grass. And, of course, mown grass, it ate so much, it burst its belly, because it hadn't got to chew it up like you have ordinary grass, you see. It's a very sad thing, that. Other pets we had, of course... We had a giant turtle after going to the... What were those islands? G-A-L-A-P-O-S.
Galapagos.
Yeah, Galapagos Island. Well, they have these giant turtles. I have a picture of a lot in my diary. Incidentally, seeing you at work now, I realize how awfully important words must be to you with no illustration to illustrate it all.
Of course, yes, that's true. I think that in 1925, you had to give an intelligence report on the military and naval activity on the islands of the Japanese Mandate.
Yes.
In the Pacific.
Now, wait a minute. Don't tell me. Pelew Island was the westernmost one. Then there were it was Micronesia. The area of small islands, as opposed to Polynesia, the many islands, and Melanesia, the big islands.
Can you tell me what you did on that trip?
Well, we went to Ponape, was the farthest east of them. Ponape, Truk, which figured a lot in World War II, Yap, and...
Palau?
The Pelew Islands, yes. Pelew was a British admiral, but it signified into Palau. We were trying to find out what the Japanese were doing, which was plenty, and we had a fairly successful trip. We also had some shooting and fishing over the stern of the ship when we went below 8 knots.
Did you have any trouble with the Japanese then?
No, they dogged you. They dogged you about the whole time. And they were great nuisance if they came shooting with you in their white uniforms. They were doing their job, which was keeping an eye on the English who were engaged in espionage. It's all quite civil.
Did they realise that you were gathering intelligence?
Well, it wouldn't be anything else. It wouldn't occur to them. They have an espionage or orientation, so to speak.
What impression did you get of the Japanese Navy?
Oh, the Navy? Well, it's pretty good. They certainly socked us in World War II. But they are fundamentally very stupid people.
In what way?
Well, it's hard to find. The Chinese are very clever people. The Japanese are bad linguists, one thing. Chinese are very good linguists. The Japanese take it very hard to understand your point of view. They go to endless trouble. But now, at that same time, there was always an international force in Shanghai. And the wireless experts had a weekly meeting, I think on a Monday or so. And on the Tuesday, the Japanese always had another very, very secret meeting. And finally, I asked them what on earth was going on. Well, we spent our whole time saying, what the devil are those chaps at? We were trying to understand what happened the day before. Besides being badly English, they are fundamentally rather thick.
You mean thick in an uncomprehending type of way?
Yes, yes, exactly, yes.
You...
And of course, they have a rather permissive attitude towards taking human life. As you know, the men commit them hairy-curry. They kneel on a mat, which they turned over, so not to stain the proper side with blood, and then they cut their bellies open like that. But the women also have their hairy-curry. They put a knife down inside their collarbone, the heart like that.
Downwards?
Yes. And I didn't touch that then. And I had a very good time in Japan before I was doing this work, because a Japanese ambassador in London had been entertained by my parents, and they're very, very good at returning sort of favors like that. And I was taken once to the Peiresses' school, and Peiresses' daughter's school, rather. Apparently, we've been taught the feminine method of hairy-curry, because I saw them all doing, been practicing this thing with a knife. Rather gruesome.
What do you mean by the Peiresses' school?
The daughters of peers. Of
the aristocracy.
Nobility is a better word, yes.
In 1925, you had to go in Bluebell on a visit to Nanking. Tell me why you went there?
Yes. There were three competing armies fighting around Nanking, and one of them suddenly changed sides, and the fighting became very confused, with Nanking being threatened. And so we rushed up there and landed our little pathetic little force of sailors, 30 sailors, to protect them. Presently the fighting... Well, presently a cruiser came to support us, one of the C-class cruisers, and he came too fast up the river, the Yangtze, having forgotten to shut us turns, cuttles, and flooded the officer's bathroom out for our great amusement. And we laid elaborate plans for bombarding and so on. You always do, and then the thing dies down, and trade resumes and so on.
Did any of the Blue Jackets go ashore?
Yes, always. I mean, you're encouraged to go ashore. And there's very often, they probably, pretty often, allowed to use the local customs club, you see, and things like that. You did all you could to give them a good time ashore.
But did they go ashore in Nanking?
This particular time, I look at Nanking itself, man, it was a long way from the river. They said, they go, sure, you can give them leave, or you give them leave, you can possibly give, if it's safe enough.
Um, later on, in either 1925 or 26, late 1925 or early 1926, when you were back in Hong Kong, I think there was the circulation of communist pamphlets on the lower deck.
Yes.
Can you tell me what
I've really forgotten all about it. It was something that happened periodically. They were always very, very badly produced, with very little knowledge of sales psychology, and things were taken out as a joke.
Was it produced by British communists?
I imagine so. Certainly by English-speaking ones.
What type of things were they trying to say in these pamphlets?
Have I got one? Yes, I have. I can't think where it is now. Mostly, isn't it awfully unfair that officers are paid so much more? They'd pick on a chaplain and say the sky pie is paid so much, so many times your pay, and so on. They just pick up all the usual grievances which the lower deck have and try to work them up into something.
Why do you think that they misunderstood the psychology of the lower deck?
They didn't see enough of the sailors to get to understand them. They didn't try to understand. They've all got a very missionary aspect there to common. Communism is a religion, and they've got to realise that. And missionaries never seem to understand the slightest bit about the people they're trying to convert. In fact, all the missionary ever left, to my knowledge, was the missionary position in making love, which, you know, which is our usual one, prone, the man on top, which they found awfully funny. It was known as the missionary position, which they would never thought of using themselves.
This was the Chinese, was it?
Chinese, yes. And many other natives, too.
What position did the Chinese use?
A very curious one, squatting. The man is sort of squatting on the ground, the woman on her back in front of you, with her legs pulled up each side of him.
Coming back to the communist pamphlets, how were these communist pamphlets received by the lower deck?
As a joke. In fact, when I offered to give them a lecture on communism, an unbiased lecture on communism, they said they weren't really interested. It's all too theoretical for them. What they were interested in was in their pay and their food, and above all, the money available to bring up their families and so on.
Did the lower deck seem contented with their conditions?
Yes, reasonably. One did everything one possibly could to make them good, to improve their quarters, and so on. And I even organised. You see, the old sailor, when I first went to sea, went on a fortnight's leave, carrying in his hand a large blue handkerchief tied up at the four corners. Well, then they graduated very quickly to suitcases. And I remember trying to find space to put up racks for suitcases.
Did the lower deck ever express any grievances?
Oh, yes. I mean, if they had one, you want them to come forward and tell them. Sometimes, of course, it wasn't very easy. But I must say, I noticed in the army, it's funny about that, they seem to have no recognised machinery. Though they recognised machinery, for putting forward their grievances. Well, you would depend upon a master at arms, a chief boatswain's mate and so on, to canalise them and come and tell you if they think something is wrong. And, of course, you can get very badly let down and not realise a grievance until it's gone too far.
Were there any special problems peculiar to the Far East as far as managing the men was concerned?
Well, yes, the climate, the great heat. You got more so, of course, in East India Station. But the climate made it very hot. They got fearful prickly heat. And you had we had a doctor on board, of course, tell them they must not scratch themselves. And so on and so on. We had a naval camp on the peak, the highest hill in Hong Kong. And you'd send the youngest men up there when he went to refit and so on.
Were there any special problems in serving in the Far East from being so remote from home? Did that create any special problems?
Yes, but it solved itself while you were out there by air transport, you see. When I first went out there, if a chap had a was in trouble, he learned it took a month to get home. If he was a very clever chap, he could send it by Siberia, but it wasn't very, very safe that way. And a month to get a reply, and of course in 2 months, an awful lot of things can get worse. But with air transport and air mail, above all air mail, things could be solved fairly quickly.
In the 1920s, did any British servicemen go back to Britain via the Trans-Siberian Railway?
One friend of mine, I wanted to go myself, but I got ill or something and couldn't make it. I had to go the other way. Oh, yes, enterprising people used it. In fact, there was a story about some chap who was given an isolated job somewhere near Wei Hai Wei and liked it enormously, applied to have it renewed for 2 periods. And the authorities got rather worried and discovered that he went home by Trans-Siberia and lived in his club in Pall Mall.
Now, in 1934, you returned to the Far East after you'd left the Royal Navy. Can you tell me about the circumstances under which you returned to the Far East?
Yes, I went out with a mission of penetrating the armed forces of Japan. And I had to find my own cover, and I dug in eventually as assistant trade commissioner. Because if I'd got a job in Jardine Matheson or Butterfield and Swire, there'd have been great jealousy and inquiries. But a trade commissioner was a government appointment, and so it wasn't queried very much.
Who gave you this commission to do this?
I suppose that's a classified question. It's pretty obvious. Let me leave it like that. The Secret Service.
But how did they recruit you to do it? Why did they choose you?
Well, I dabbled in intelligence work before and sent in reports and so on. I always rather liked it. And one morning, I'd left the Navy then. There was a letter on my desk. Dear Mr. J, please come in. A very round, schoolboy, unformed handwriting. It was... Dear Miss Drake, come and see me in my office one day next week, my secretary will arrange, and sign one word hanky, the Secretary of the Cabinet. We didn't argue that. I went to see him, and I was out to China about a fortnight later. He was a very great man.
Can you describe your interview with him and how he put the task
to
you?
No, he knew all about it. Well, he then sent me on to CC, inverted commas C, the head of the Secret Service. And we talked a bit about it, and... He told me to fix my own salary when I got there and find my own cover, and I went out.
To fix your own salary?
Yes. I mean, obviously, in fact, he even showed me an enormous ledger with all his accounts in it. Things were done like that in the Secret Service in those days.
Did you have any apprehensions about taking this task?
I was very careful about it all. But yes, I was a bit apprehensive sometimes. But the danger is much more what some lunatic might do to you than any well-planned assassination attempt. Generally speaking, you see, if you get the head of the other side intelligence, you cherish him like a brother and trust him to lead you to all the other people. With the Japanese, you couldn't quite know. One knew so little about them, you see.
Where did you disembark when you arrived in Japan?
Oh, God knows. I went there several times, you see. Probably Nagasaki. Maybe Tokyo, which is also a port. I rarely forget that.
And so where were you working most of the time? In Tokyo?
No, I was working back in outside China. Outside Japan, I mean. From Hong Kong or Shanghai, Hong Kong, in fact.
So your base was in Hong Kong and you paid these visits to Japan?
Yes, but not very many. I preferred to send other people.
When you visited yourself, how did you go about this intelligence work?
I didn't do any. I preferred to get Chinese students, coach them carefully in what I wanted to know, and get them back after a bit, interrogate them, coach them again, send them off again. It's very pedestrian work.
What type of things were... What type of facts were you trying to gather?
Well, information about the armed forces, about the new O-type or O-type fighter, about all kinds of things. Mostly turned out not to be true.
Why do you think it turned out not to be true? Because
because there's a great deal more legend and rumours than there is hard truth. That's merely a fact of life. But sometimes, of course, one had successes and sometimes one had great failures. One thing, for instance, poison gas. When the war began, when the Pearl Harbor happened, I had 8 Japanese gas weapons in my office. All kinds of things, a grenade, various types of candles, an aeroplane bomb, even 50-kilogram bomb, and they never used gas again. You didn't mind using gas against the Chinese, you couldn't hit back. But they weren't going to use gas against the Americans and have a load of AIM dropped on them or something, you see.
Load of what?
AIM.
What's that?
I don't know, actually. It was a very secret gas, as far as I remember, the Americans had. But they did use gas, of course, against the guerrillas. A girl called Ada Chan, I was very fond of at one time. This is all more or less distant. It isn't broadcast, sort of. I was killed. She had a little band of guerrillas. She was a cabaret dancer who got a fit of patriotism and joined this little band. And they were being chased by Japanese and took refuge in one of those, you know, grey square-walled villages in the middle of a sea of paddy, and the Japanese got to windward, let go some gas cannon, and shot them down like rabbits. They ran away.
When was this?
Heavens. 37 or 38, I think.
You said that there were some successes in this intelligence work. Some successes, yes, in this intelligence work. Can you remember any specific successes?
Well, that's what I was really thinking of. All the gases, which were never used. But I think it rated a success. And sometimes I got things right and sometimes wrong.
Were any of the Chinese whom you sent to Japan ever discovered by the Japanese in this work?
I don't think so. They may have been. I really forget all that.
Whilst you were serving in China, did you ever hear very much about the work of the Chinese communists in China?
Yes, they're very unpopular. They're very, very frightened of them. And they're more important up in the northwest, of course, in Siberia, where they are on the borders of Russia.
Who were they unpopular with?
The Chinese. They're very scared of the whole thing. China had two great enemies, Russia and Japan. Luckily, of course, they fought each other.
Did you ever hear of Mao Zedong whilst you...
Who?
Mao Zedong. Did you ever hear of him whilst you were in the forest?
I heard of him, yes. He was a sort of vague and very important figure in the back of Sichuan. I also heard of who was the famous the Russian General Garland, Blücher, who was a mysterious but very well figure.
What did you hear of him?
He's a very able man and very, very important in the Soviet hierarchy.
Did you ever hear about any of the other Comintern agents, such as M.N. Roy?
No, I don't remember any. Wasn't he Indian?
Yes.
Yes, and I...
Coming back to your intelligence mission to penetrate the Japanese in 1934, how long did this work last?
Oh, till the end of the war.
So it was from 1934 to 1945?
Yes, roughly speaking. But, of course, I cleared out and... They took Hong Kong, obviously. I'd gone to Singapore, and before they took Singapore, I got out to Calcutta.
At what stage did the Japanese appear to you to be a threat to the British position in the Far East? About what type? What year were they
beginning? Well, as I went out to penetrate the forces, they appeared from that moment, I mean. I wouldn't have been sent out otherwise.
Had they appeared to be a threat to the British position in the Far East in the 20s when you were there?
Well, obviously, yes, but one thought much more in terms of internal troubles in China.
When the Far East War broke out in 1941, was it thought that the Japanese would be militarily successful?
Not so successful. They were obviously going to go a very long way. But one thought Hong Kong might hold out for 6 weeks. And Hong Kong held out for a fortnight. One thought Singapore would hold out 6 months. And Singapore held out barely 6 weeks. We didn't know how good they were. We didn't know if the Japanese 5th Division, the elite division, had been specially trained in amphibious warfare. We didn't know how far they'd proceeded with the occupation of Hainan, I know, big island off the bottom right-hand corner, Hainan Island and so on.
When you left the Far East in 1926, after your period of naval service there, were you sad to leave or glad to get out?
Well, I'm glad to go on leave, I mean, otherwise I'd have very happy 2.5 years.
Why was it so happy in the Far East? Why was it so good to be there?
Well, I was in a very happy little ship, and I was doing work I liked and understood and enjoyed very much. I had a very nice captain, and the officers all became lifelong friends of mine. And there were so many things to do there. I'm a great sightseer. Well, you'd suddenly go to a place like Bangkok, you see, which you've never had long enough to explore properly. I liked sightseeing, I liked meeting people, I liked shooting very much. It was a perfect life for me.
Did you ever have the chance to go into the Chinese interior?
Not very much, no. Communication was so bad. I went up to Canton, and on one occasion I went up the line towards Hankow, but no, not a great deal. You were very isolated, you see. The communication, the Japanese found out, were lines of flags.